All right, it's the Fan Drive time. It is your Friday. It is January the 7th. Arash Madani, Stephen Brunt with you. Ben Ennis has the day off, and we are not in studio, and we're dealing with some technical issues because why wouldn't we be? It's Omicron. It's the times we live in. Mr. Brunt, how are we doing this evening?
Arash, good to hear you even on that phone line. We're going to get that straightened out any moment now, I think. But yes, this is
a promise or a threat?
Yeah, it is both. But yes, this harkens back to a lot of our made-up radio that we've had to do at times over the last 2 years. So we're very adaptable these days, I find. That's I guess that's a plus, right?
We are. I guess it is. We are beholden to technology and the rest. And it's amazing to me that here we are on the 7th of January, coming up on what? Nearly 2 years into this pandemic, and still the COVID issue obviously is front and center. But through this entire week, maybe the number one story in sports remains Novak Djokovic. There are so many different angles to this. I know you and Ben have talked about this throughout the week. But to me, what's just wild is the political hot potato animal that this thing has become federally in Australia. And it's one thing with Novak, who basically came out and almost embarrassed the Australian government by saying, hey, looky here, I got myself an exemption. But there's a Czech tennis player, Renata Voráčková, who had already entered the country. She had already played a tune-up tournament. She was doing her thing and had dotted all her I's and crossed all her T's. And suddenly they scooped her up and threw her in the same hotel as Djokovic, who was appealing the visa cancellation. And so all of a sudden, if you're watching this, you're saying to yourself, well, wait a minute, what's happening here? Like, Novak didn't fill out his visa paperwork properly. That's why you're detaining him. But another player who did things the way you have outlined them to be, suddenly Renata Voráčková ends up in the exact same scenario as Djokovic?
Well, yeah, this is an interesting twist to the story. You're correct. The political situation in Australia is pretty easy to understand, especially right now if you're living in Ontario in a half lockdown and maybe feeling a bit cranky about it. And you know, in Australia, in parts of Australia, especially Melbourne, where the tournament is happening, they went through months of extreme lockdown, way more extreme than anything we've experienced here. They were kind of pursuing the zero COVID path, and it was brutal on the citizens of the city of Melbourne. So the notion that somebody that's, you know, Djokovic, as you say, was kind of going, you know, looky here, I got this, I'm on my way, and you know, medical exemption for an unvaccinated person, the grounds for a medical exemption are really, really narrow. And of course, there's no transparency here, which is, you know, that's what's got to happen to start with is, you know, I guess a lot of people might have been skeptical that the number one tennis player in the world coming to play the Australian Open, who is a out front anti-vaxxer, also just happened to fit within that very, very narrow category of somebody who could justifiably ask for a medical exemption and arrive in the country unvaccinated. Like that seems kind of a miracle, right?
Right.
So people are angry and people are cynical, and the Prime Minister, and that was a state decision, the state of Victoria, which is where Melbourne is. So the Prime Minister of Australia, waded into this. And again, you could, like, let's put it in our own context here. You can imagine this happening, saying, hang on a second. That's not the, like, you know, he's still got, it's our border. He still has to get through our border. He has to get past our border force. And we've got some questions that need answering here. And it sounds like in terms of the visa application, they may have just found a technicality. But I think, you know, the larger question is still, he's got a medical exemption? It's a thing in Serbia. I'll tell you though, Arash, it's not exactly like the rest of the tennis world is rallying, saying, please get Novak out of that hotel and let him play. Like,
no, that's true.
Not a lot of patience for this guy and his anti-vax among his fellow tennis players.
But the one who has come out a little bit, and they've had their issues in the past, and I thought, you know, this was an interesting take from Nick Kyrgios, who is Australian. And his tweet from I don't know, 18 hours ago or so. He said, look, I definitely believe in taking action. I got vaccinated because of others and for my mom's health. But what Kyrgios has said was, how we are handling Novak's situation is bad, really bad, like these memes, headlines. This is one of our great champions, but at the end of the day, he is human. Do better. Okay, I understand that side of it too. And Djokovic was only going to come to Australia if he got an exemption. So what, he wasn't going to come if he had not been given an assurance. So is this on Tennis Australia? Is this on the state of Victoria? Is this the federal government in Australia saying, hold on, after they saw the social media message and then the outcry within the country? This is Novak being caught in the middle of a political firestorm. That's all this is.
Yeah, it's you're correct. All of those things, you know, there are a bunch of questions to be answered about who. I read all perhaps they protest too much, but all of the talk about how this, no, it was a blind committee. The committee reviewing this didn't know it was him, and it was absolutely above board, et cetera, et cetera. But again, you know, medical exemptions aren't something that are easily doled out. And it's hard to, you know, you go through the categories there and say, man, it's hard to imagine any of those apply to him. He did have COVID in 2020, but that's too long ago to get an exemption for that. The idea that you're immune after having the disease. And it is political. You're right. And again, if you are correct in the sense that if somebody sent him and his people assurances, he filled out the form and they said, well, you're all clear, come on to Australia. It's not his fault if he got onto a plane to Australia. It's his fault. You know, it's his fault who he is and what he's decided to, how he's decided to play. It's like, look, I'm like a lot of people. I don't have any sympathy for that position. Zero.
Nor do I.
But I can't blame him for getting on the plane if they told him it was okay.
Right. Right. And it's the story that doesn't go away. Now he's got another athlete lumped into the same situation as him, even though who knows what Renata Voroncova's scenario would be. So stay tuned. Djokovic is appealing the cancellation of his visa. He is said to have a hearing Monday where he is appealing this, and he'll get before a judge in Australia to see how this is handled. Voroncova, meanwhile, said, okay, I'm done with it. I'm leaving. If this is how we're going to do things, I'm out. So stay tuned. The saga feels like has been going on for quite some time, but in reality, it's only kind of beginning. Sad news today in the world of Canadian football. Caught many of us by surprise who follow the institution of it. Larry Haler died today at the age of 76. He was Western's football coach, for the better part of a quarter century. When he retired, he was the most winning coach in Canadian university football history. 2 national championships. He did not have a losing season during all of his years at Western, was the national coach of the year a couple of times. Steve, I'm not much for numbers on radio, but 178 wins and 43 losses. Larry Haler was a legend. He was a giant. He was a pillar, a fixture, and a Hall of Famer, inducted into the Canadian Football Hall of Fame in 2014.
Yeah, it's quite a you know, I'm going to wear my colors on my sleeve here, Rush. I know you went to another purple school, but I went to what was then the University of Western Ontario, now Western University. And it's a sad coincidence. Darwin Simotiuk, who was Larry Haler's predecessor as coach, died 2 days before Larry Haler did. So those two guys died within 2 days of each other in the past week. Western football, and I know people who didn't go to Western tend to hate Western, and I get it, right? But that they've run an unbelievable football program since I was in school and before I was in school there. Like I was at the, as a high school student, I was at the 1976 Vanier Cup that Darwin Simotiuk's Western team won. Before him, you know, when I went to campus, when I first got to campus at Western, there was a guy named Johnny Metris who was still around, kind of hanging around on campus, who had coached from 1938, I think it was, till 1969. Frank Cosentino, who's still, thank God, is still with us. Frank Cosentino followed him, and then Darwin Simoniak, and then Larry Haler, and then Greg Marshall, and that's it. In the going back to the late 1930s, the pre-war era, only those five guys have ever coached Western football, and they all had tremendous success. Darwin Simoniak became the AD at Western when he handed the reins over to Larry Haler, who was his assistant, and eventually Larry, handed over the reins to Greg Marshall, kind of stepped aside when Greg came back from the Tiger Cats and said, allowed him to take over the head coaching job. Greg had obviously coached at Mac as well. So that, we talk about the Pittsburgh Steelers and the NFL, Arash, and the coaching line there, the very tiny number of coaches they've had, but the Western football has been like that. And these guys, both of those guys were giants in CIS and OUA football.
When Haler's coaching career was winding down, he did an interview with the Free Press in London. He described himself as a tough coach. He said, "I was a hard-ass coach, a demanding coach, and an insisting coach." And yet so many of the players who came through there speak so highly of them. One alumnus actually emceed Larry Haler's retirement dinner. Most of the time, we would never have somebody from TSN on the air, but Dwayne Ford is a longtime football analyst who played at Western, played for Larry Haler. He joins us now. Dwayne, condolences on the loss of your coach, of your friend. How would you describe who and what Larry Haler was, man?
Yeah, I think that Larry pretty accurately described himself in that London Free Press interview when he talked about being demanding. Larry was a guy who was an absolute preparation freak. His attention to detail was remarkable, and that was what he asked of his players. But you respected the fact that he was not asking you to prepare or perform on a level that was less than what he was giving himself. And that tells part of the story. So many people will talk about that that intensity that Larry always sort of had in the football context. But beyond that, just a great family man, and one of the things that in his post coaching days that comes up a lot is Larry is a grandfather to six little girls. And I know how much that part of his life means to him. I know how much it always meant to Larry that he had the opportunity to coach his sons, Jordan and Matthew, when they played football at Western. And his daughter, Jennifer, was an outstanding basketball player at Western. And his time being a fan in the stands watching those games. And, that's the side of Larry that we got to see occasionally that, I think provided this nice balance with the intense, demanding coach that we all knew on game day and on the practice field.
Dwayne, I don't know if you heard us talking before you came on, but I also mentioned that Darwin Simoniak died this week, as mm-hmm. 2 days before Larry, which is two of the pillars of that football program. What do you remember about you kind of when you first arrived in that Western football culture? And what struck you about it?
Yeah, the lineage, the history, and you can talk about it in the context of players as well, but obviously in coaches. I know I'm seeing the chain of emails today among former teammates, obviously upon learning of Larry's passing. And one of the things one of our teammates, Eric Ersic, mentioned the fact, and I know you guys touched on this, like since 1975, Western has only had three head football coaches. And that's Darwin Simoniak, Larry Haler, and Greg Marshall. And you look at Greg Marshall coaching there now, and you want to talk about continuity. Greg played for Darwin and was an assistant coach under Larry. And, the history, the tradition, the continuity – is absolutely remarkable. And you see the same sort of thing, that same sort of history and symmetry when you talk about players. You know, the kind of guys that are playing there now, obviously, in comparisons to guys who played there 50 years ago, and it continues on. And obviously the leadership has everything to do with that. And that, you know, Darwin Simoniak and Larry Haler played a huge, huge role in that.
What's one of your favorite Larry Haler stories, Dwayne?
You know,
one that you could share on radio,
many,
I guess,
but
anyway.
I'll tell you, one of my favorites has to do with just kind of Larry's intensity. And, you know, and I'll give you a little bit of a contrast in terms of my own experiences with Larry. And so for me, I went there in 1987 and, you know, fairly highly recruited guy. I was going there as a fullback, and this was on the heels of Blake Marshall having been drafted second overall to Edmonton. He had just won the Hec Crichton Trophy. And, you know, you're sort of going there trying to be the next Blake Marshall. And I knew what the history was of Western fullbacks at that time. And, you know, one of the things that Larry told us on the first day of training camp, he said, you know, the coaches are going to be hard on you. Coaches are going to yell at you. And he said, the time to worry isn't when the coach is yelling at you. The time to worry is when the coaches stop yelling at you, because that means they've given up. Right. And I remember at one point during the season, like from, you know, it started early in training camp, and Larry was on me all the time. He yelled at me all the time. And I think to anybody watching, I would have been doing as well as any of the rookies out there. I was one of the few rookies that even got playing time that year. We had a terrific team. But Larry was yelling at me all the time. And then we went through this stretch in the middle of the season where, you know, I felt like I had sort of fallen out of favor, and he wasn't saying much to me. And I was very aware of what his words were back in training camp. And I was thinking, why isn't Larry saying much? What's going on? And I remember being in a 3-point stance one day, and I was so nervous about making a mistake. I was literally shivering. I thought my hand in my 3-point stance was going to give out, and I was going to fall over. And from behind me, I heard this voice screaming at me, you know, something like, "Oh, Dwayne Ford, don't mess this up," or something. And I remember shivering in my 3-point stance and grinning from ear to ear because Larry Haler was back to yelling at me. And it's, you know, it was just, you know, that tone, that voice, you know, I will miss.
It sounds
sure.
It sounds like Coach Greg Marshall. There's a lot of Coach Larry Haler and Coach Greg Marshall. Like, which the intensity level? Like, if you had to rate the intensity level between those two guys, they seem kind of similar to me, Dwayne.
Yeah, I mean the Marshall intensity is obviously somewhat legendary as well. I mean, I think back to Greg during that time, and you know, the early '80s late '80s and. Obviously, a little bit of a different time in football, but Greg was the offensive line coach at that time after he'd retired from the CFL. And, I certainly remember Greg, you know, one time and somebody going down with a minor injury in practice. And, you know, he didn't have a lot of time for minor injuries, right? Everybody was playing hurt as the season went on. So as this guy is down on the field, Greg's reaction was to, let's just turn the drill around and go the other way while this guy sorts out whether he wants to be with us or not. And it was that same kind of intensity. Again, it was something that I know, you know, Greg learned from Darwin and learned from Larry. And it was definitely a big part of the culture. You know, I remember, I think it was training camp 1989 when Greg's first son, Donnie, was born during training camp. And, Greg came back to practice after the birth of his child, and, you know, we were all congratulating him. And as he told us, his son's name was Donald Larry. He named his son after our coach.
How about that? Dwayne, look, appreciate the time. Again, sorry for your loss. A giant, a Canadian football giant, Larry Haler, passing away at the age of 76 today. Thanks again, man.
Hey, my pleasure. I appreciate it, guys.
Okay, there's Dwayne Ford. Oh, man, Steve, like, this is one thing I remember about Haler. I was doing a game, calling a game. Western was playing Ottawa, and the night before the game, I think, was when he was going to set the record for most wins ever by a coach. And, you know, Dwayne talked about Haler's grandkids, and I asked Haler about the record. He said, you know, when you're in the middle of a season, you don't really think about it. That's something you reflect upon in retirement when you're sitting at the cabin or telling the grandkids some of those stories. He was acutely aware of what was going on, but wasn't going to let a record get in the way of the football season. I think that's one thing I'll remember about Larry Haler, too.
Yeah, that, you know, and also, again, that you know, like, he wasn't, you know, like, when he stepped aside as head coach, again, in order to allow Greg Marshall to take that job when Greg became available, and to kind of keep this line going that we're talking about, you know, the you know, Frank Cosentino played for Johnny Metris, you know, Greg Marshall played for Darwin Simoniak, and coached under Larry Haler. There's this unbroken line, but you know, Larry, I'm not sure he was done, and the guy, I don't know all the details of it, but it was, you know, that, like, Greg could have gotten a job somewhere else at a different school. I'm sure there were a lot of people who would have hired him. But Larry Haler allowed that succession to happen, and right. That unbroken line, which you know, it's a tough thing to do career wise. You know, most of us, you know, stepping aside in general is not the easiest thing in the world. And that's an important part of the story, not just how it began, but you know, how his coaching career ended.
Larry Haler, Western's coach, dying at the age of 76. All right, it is the final weekend of the NFL season coming up. The way you'll be watching baseball next year may be a little different nationally. Jim Nance is unavailable this week. A lot is happening with the way you're going to consume sports this weekend and moving forward. We'll talk about all that as the Fan Drive Time continues. All right, the Fan Drive Time. It is Friday the 7th of January. Arash Madani, Stephen Brunt, taking you into the weekend. Ben Ennis has the day off. The Manning cast has taken on a life of its own. Peyton and Eli have had everybody in pop culture, from Snoop Dogg to Roger Goodell, Tom Brady joining them. The second screen has become such a thing. And I think it started with the College Football National Championship, which is coming up Monday night. Like, if you're in the States, you can watch so many different versions of that game. You can have different coaches following it along. You can get the Alabama feed and the Georgia feed. You can watch different angles of it. And Steve, this thing is not going away. The Manning cast with Peyton and Eli is now taking on, from the baseball side, Michael Kay and A-Rod are now going to be involved on that with Sunday Night Baseball. They're going to have something separate. You know, our colleagues down the hall, Steve Dangle's got the YouTube show that during Leaf games, Leaf playoff games, there's Dangle reacting to what's happening on the ice. The way we consume our sports just continues to change rapidly. And I'm really, really beginning to wonder what the next thing is that we're going to be seeing on that front.
You know, the most interesting part of this to me, Arash, is that I think, you know, as the technology was evolving, there was a lot of talk about the idea of people kind of, that you would be able to control your own broadcast, right? You could control which camera angles you had and maybe which audio feed you had, and you could kind of essentially be like the guy, like a truck producer calling the shots on a game, and that would be really attractive. But, you know, what's actually kind of caught fire is the opposite of that, right? It's conversation. It's people, you know, it's sometimes very serious conversation, like, you know, like you talked about the college football stuff where coaches are breaking this stuff down in a coach kind of way, or, you know, Steve Dangle, the kind of, you know, the crazy fan kind of part of it, the passionate fan watching a game and you watch with him, or the Mannings, who are, you know, super charming and very easygoing and very relaxed and, you know, have, as you said, a bunch of great guests. That the idea that, you know, what people want is not kind of whiz bang, boy, I can invert the shot and see it from a different angle. What they actually want are to, you know, the kind of replicate the experience of sitting in a bar or sitting in a family room watching a game with your buddies.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they get, not only do they get premier guests, they get guests who come on and they're pretty authentic. It's almost like one of those late night talk shows while a football game is going on. Let's welcome in Jimmy Trainor from Sports Illustrated and the host of the SI Media podcast. What's the next thing that we're going to see, Jimmy? What are we expecting networks to do coming up down the pike?
I think you're going to see more Manning casts, that's for sure. And they're not going to be good, but that's also for sure. ESPN struck gold with Peyton and Eli, and everyone will copy that, and you won't really get. Listen, I think you may get one or two that can be entertaining, but most of the other ones will be really bad.
Yeah, that is the question, right? Like, that's obviously is whether they beat this thing to death, right? Whether you try it, everybody tries to replicate it, everybody tries for their own, and the whatever magic you had with the first time around, you can't just transplant that. Like, which is my immediate reaction when I heard that I could spend an evening with A-Rod watching a baseball game. Like that just didn't feel the same to me. I don't know about you, Jimmy.
Yeah, that I don't understand on any level at all, and I think obviously that'll be a complete and utter disaster in terms of ratings and reaction. There's no one, you know, I don't know what the story is there in Toronto, but I can tell you here in the United States of America, there's nobody here who's clamoring for Alex Rodriguez on television.
Yeah, what is the fascination with A-Rod? I mean, he feels like he was so 10 years ago, and I get that he was polarizing on Sunday Night Baseball. Do they feel that he breaks into the pop culture scene and that may draw some eyeballs? Is that the allure?
I think that was the allure while he was with J-Lo, and now he's not with J-Lo, and now he's off the main broadcast for Sunday Night Baseball, and they've come up with this other concoction. I think ESPN likes the fact that he's a train wreck. I think ESPN likes the fact that he gets a lot of attention, even though 95% of it is negative. And, you know, there's some weirdo executive in Bristol who is enamored by A-Rod for whatever reason.
That's as good an explanation as any. The weirdo executive in Bristol. I will take that explanation because I haven't got a better one, I got to tell you. Jimmy, when you first heard about the Manning cast, before you saw it, Did you think it would work? Did it make sense to you?
No. Peyton Manning had been rumored for years to become an NFL analyst, and he's turned it down. He's been pursued and turned it down. And I had always maintained, I have no idea if Peyton Manning would be good on TV as an analyst or even in the betting case. All of you have never seen him do it before. And, you know, there's been ex-players, ex-coaches in the past who do it, get into broadcasting, and you think they'll be good, and they're a huge nun. You know, Joe Montana was someone like that, a couple of other coaches. So sort of, I wasn't, this is going to be great, and I wasn't like, oh, this is going to stink. I was like, okay, let me see what we're going to do here, what this is going to be about. I think they've executed it perfectly. I think they should maybe cut back on the guests. I don't think they need four guests for telecast. I think they can get away with two or three. I think what's become clear is people who watch it want to see Peyton and Eli. And yes, you can get a guest in there who's very entertaining and amusing and mix it up with them, and that's great. You don't need four. You need two or three. Give people a lot of Peyton and Eli. I didn't really know what it would be, and I had heard, I'm good friends with Kyle Brandt from Good Morning Football. He had auditioned to be a host on it before they decided not to use a host. And when Kyle had the test run, he said, this is going to be amazing. So once I heard that, I sort of expected it to be pretty good.
Kyle Brandt from the NFL Network. The big news on the MLB Network side this week, Jimmy, was Ken Rosenthal getting whacked by the channel that baseball owns and operates. Reportedly, apparently, Rob Manfred was not pleased with the criticism that Rosenthal had of him, you know, when they were trying to get the 2020 season off the ground after COVID. And what a brutal look for Manfred in a series of brutal looks for Manfred. But now suddenly credibility in question. And it doesn't matter what your network is, news, sports, entertainment, whatever, Once credibility becomes questioned, then you have major issues. What in your mind is going to be the fallout of this thing?
Well, to be honest with you, I sort of have a different take than most people. The MLB Network is owned and run by MLB.
Mm-hmm.
The NFL Network is owned and run by the NFL. If you think people are going to get on there and criticize the commissioner and the league, here's what I would say. People are very upset that Rosenthal got booted for criticizing Manfred, and I get why. I mean, I totally get it. Do you think there's anyone on the NFL Network criticizing Roger Goodell? These leagues own the networks. So, yes, it's going to be propaganda. I'm surprised people would be expecting it to be anything else. Now, Ted Rosenthal is an excellent reporter. I don't think he's a propagandist. But I am not surprised that the MLB Network, which is owned by MLB, does not want someone on there bashing their commissioner, because I don't think it would happen on the NFL Network. I don't think it would happen on the NHL Network. And I don't think it would happen on the NBA Network.
Is this I agree with you to start, but I wonder, you know, as leagues and teams increasingly kind of try to take control of their own content and, you know, and monetize their own content, you know, this was not something that was happening, you know, 10, 15 years ago, but now, you know, every team has you know, at least, you know, a web platform, but, you know, often more than that. I think this, I'm, you know, kind of a, I've most sports conversation, if it's critical of a team or critical of a player, or critical of a coach, that's part of the churn. That's part of the content. And I don't think anybody's going to bother censoring it, because that's what, you know, that's part of what you're selling, right? The fan conversation.
Right.
But I wonder, you know, just about, you know, like, you can't pull the pillars down. And, you know, if more and more of the content is going to be driven directly by the leagues and by the teams, you know, who is going to stand up and criticize an owner or criticize a commissioner?
People who don't work for the networks.
Yep.
I mean, that's really, you know, that, you know, I'm not going to make this about me and my own ego, but I've always said Sports Illustrated is such a great fit for me because we're not attached to any league. So I can say what I want about any announcer. I worked for a couple of years at Fox and wrote for their website, and I was told a couple of times to not write this, not write that, because they, MLB, NFL. So you just got to look. Whoever is not in bed with the leagues are the people who can criticize and, you know, hold them up to certain standards. The MLB Network, though, is not going to take on the commissioner. It's just not going to happen. I want to be clear about something. I think it's a terrible look for Manfred. I mean, he looks very weak and babyish. But at the end of the day, no league is going to have someone on their own network bash the commissioner. So it's not going to happen.
Yeah. No. And fully now, these networks, these platforms are controlling more and more of the message. They're controlling more and more of the access. And so you just wonder what kind of transparency, if any,
well,
is going to be.
I don't know. I mean, listen, you have The Athletic, which is obviously in the news because they got bought by the Times. They're independent. They're not entangled with any of the leagues. There are plenty of outlets. You know, USA Today, they're not involved with any leagues. There are plenty out there that can. But don't look for ESPN to go all in on the leagues. Don't look for Fox. Don't look for CBS. You know, they have partnerships, and they're going to maintain those partnerships and toe the line.
Jimmy, have a great weekend. We appreciate the time, man.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Be well.
Okay. There's from Sports Illustrated, Jimmy Traina. It's an interesting dynamic now, because teams have their own content platforms. They have their own social creators. They have access with those staff members to go into locker rooms, to go into clubhouses, and create and produce content that nobody else has access to, especially now with, you know, COVID protocols removing a lot of the access that once was. And so it feels like you're either in the inner sanctum or you're out. And if you're in that inner sanctum, don't you dare criticize. Or even if they're willing to do it, if they're willing to do that with Ken Rosenthal, that means all bets are off.
Well, but I'm not surprised, and I think what Jimmy said, I agree with that. You know, that's in the same way that NFL.com is not going to take a run at Roger Goodell. These guys are not going to, and MLB.com is not going to take a direct run at Rob Manfred. Rob Manfred looks thin-skinned, and Jimmy said weak, and overly sensitive. But it is their outlet by definition and by name. You know, it's so that. I say that doesn't shock me, and again, you could have. I think there are other kinds of discussions and content that you can drive on those kind of platforms. You know, anything about the sport is probably fair game. But again, it doesn't shock me that if it's something at a time when it's kind of when we're in the middle of a nasty collective bargaining situation and a lockout that they might get super sensitive about any criticism. You know, again, I'm not saying that's the greatest thing for the world. I just think it's not surprising. But the other kind of access is a different story, because most of that's not, that doesn't really have anything to do with the questioning the fundamentals or calling out the boss. It's just the day-to-day stuff of sport, the access to athletes, getting their stories, hearing what they have to say, the content that we pack around games, that that's part of the fan conversation, and that is in its own way as much of is as much the product as the games are, and that that's a separate thing, because teams and leagues have figured out that they don't really, they have rights holders that they have to deal with, for sure. As of now, they have rights holders. But the idea of direct delivering, controlling your own content, delivering it directly, controlling the message, and controlling the access, like the only reason that leagues didn't do that in the past is that they couldn't. That there wasn't, in terms of technology, you needed a platform, you needed a media company, you needed newspapers, you needed reporters to go in and do that work for you, and you just put the games on and paid the athletes. Nobody in sports is operating like that anymore, and all the trend lines would tell you that they are increasingly going to run their own platforms, their own channels, whatever you want to call them, and they're going to try and monetize that content rather than letting somebody else monetize the content, and monetize the exclusivity. So
yeah, and I think I don't think it's just the monetization. I think it's the controlling of the message. I think that's a big part of this.
Well, yeah, to a point it is. But if your team stinks, you're not going to. There's no point in going on your outlet and saying the team's good, because fans don't believe that. They want to have. There's going to be opinion, and there's going to be you want that churn, right? That's not every season is a championship season. Coaches get fired, managers get fired. Players get succeed or fail. That stuff's still part of it. So it's not gonna. I don't think it'll turn into one dimensional happy stories all the time, because that would be counterproductive. But I think they want to control as much and own as much of that churn as they can, and it makes sense. Like if I was running a team right now, I would be building my content department. I would be spending all, because why the hell not? Why not do it yourself? Why not direct deliver it to your fans? And that's mostly what fans want. They want to hear about the players. They want to hear what's going on in the get a sense of what's going on in the dressing room or the clubhouse. They want to hear about the draft pick. They want to hear about all that kind of stuff. They want to dip into nostalgia every once in a while. All of those things you can do, and you don't really need a middleman. And I hate to say that, because I made a career working for the middleman.
Sure. The Athletic thing is interesting, because they came out with such bravado. They were so brash. They said they were going to take down and destroy newspapers, and then it ends up being a newspaper that buys them. What's your sense, Steve, on what this is going to be?
I think it's going to be more of the same in the short term. The Athletic did manage to grow with a subscription system, managed to get a subscriber base of a million people, over a million people, which is a lot of people never thought they could do that. Now they've, there's been some deep, deep discounting in the last year, so that maybe is part of it. And, they've been looking for a bite. Like, this thing was built to sell. A couple of venture capitalists started it. They were not you know, they didn't do it for this. This isn't like the National back in the day with Frank DeFord and all those highly paid writers trying to put out the best sports newspaper in history. This is, you know, guys who are building something to sell, and they've done it. You know, they've cashed out now. They've and kept jobs, which is nice for them. And the Times is also apparently just trying to drive it's trying to get past what 8 million subscribers globally. They have been the one newspaper, whatever you want to call it. Newspaper is probably not the right word anymore, but they have managed to build a global audience with a subscription base. I was reading a piece today that said there are more paid subscribers to the New York Times in Dallas right now than there are to the Dallas Morning News.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, so they have become a global news brand, and they're the one kind of example of success. But, you know, even then, they have bought other things that haven't necessarily in the same kind of vein that trying to buy new media that didn't necessarily work out for them. But we'll see. The Times is not really a sports publication. They don't do day-to-day sports. That's very feature driven. They don't have any columnists anymore. The Athletic still has a great roster of talent. And we'll see, how they, and it ran on, and ran on an algorithm basis, right? Like if you're a writer there, the number of clicks and the number of people who subscribed after reading your stories was where your job security came from. So,
right.
I don't know if the Times will continue to run it that way. But I guess the bottom line is, Arash, there's a bunch of folks in our business who are still going to have jobs, and I hope they continue to have jobs and do good work. You know, some of the best people in our business are working there.
Yeah, no, they really are. And for sports print journalism, the concern, the fear had always been, what happens if the Athletic goes belly up? Because the Athletic had recruited and headhunted and basically pried away some of the best beat writers from newspapers all across North America. You know, if you wanted Aaron Portsline in Columbus, best beat writer in Columbus, there he was with the Athletic Columbus. And across it went. They brought in some big-time columnists. The question was, if the Athletic can't make this go, if the Athletic can't survive after prying everybody away, what happens then? So it is interesting that the New York Times, yes, by name they are quote-unquote New York-based, but you don't have a day-to-day Jets beat writer talking about, you know, injuries and transactions. I was talking to somebody at the baseball postseason. At the time, I think they had something like, Steve, around 35 sports writers. Mm-hmm. And not one was assigned to a New York, at the time, a New York basketball team or a New York hockey team.
Yeah, they went with a completely different model. And it's been interesting. And but in terms of the Athletic kind of trying to take down newspapers and compete, like it wasn't a fair fight because newspapers were, of their own volition and their own bad planning and their own lack of foresight were falling apart. So, mm-hmm. people were falling out of a broken business and landing at the Athletic. And then they headhunted some really good people. I cheer for sports journalism. I cheer for good people being able to do their jobs and get paid. I hated it when those guys said they were going to try and, bury the newspaper sports section. But I'm glad that, there's some kind of a business model surviving where some of our confreres can continue to do good work and I can continue to read it because I subscribe.
Yeah, no question. No question. It's the Fan Drive Time. It's Friday. We're about to take the break, but before we do, what's old is new again, and what's new is old again. Just get word, was it last night or earlier today, that Rudy Gobert has tested positive again, and I'm like, okay, it really is March of 2020 all over again. It's the Jazz and the Raptors tonight without Gobert. There's been this push for Fred VanVleet for the All-Star. Talk about what old is new again, that a Toronto athlete needs a push to get into some kind of All-Star game. And Steve, do you think that's going to happen? Do you think this is one of those deals where, under the radar Fred is going to sneak in? Is this something of significance anymore? Like, I don't think it is, but for a certain portion of the fan base, this is a thing.
Well, it's. I think they've seen him play heroically this year, play crazy numbers of minutes this year, and would like to see a guy like him acknowledged. And, you know, I get it. I think it would be meaning. I'm sure it would be meaningful to him. I've spent zero time thinking about how to construct an all-star roster in the NBA. But, I don't think a lot of people in the city, I'd love to see him on it.
Yeah. He's just been so pivotal to what the Raptors have been able to do, kind of navigating them out of some real dark times earlier this season. It seems like they're out of it on the other side. Raptors and Jazz tonight. The Raptors are only one of the basketball stories in this country this week. Big news from our national teams. Michael Bartlett, the CEO of Basketball Canada, he's coming up next. It's the Fan Drive time.